Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cup podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Holfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 6 of season 10. I've been using Boris Effects products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with editor Keith Fraze about the Oscar Best Picture nominated film, Past Lives. Keith is also nominated for an Ace Eddie for Best Edited Dramatic Feature for the film. Keith's past work includes the feature films Knight of Cups, To the Wonder, Chappaquiddick, and Song to Song. Before I hop into our discussion with Keith, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to BorisFX.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to BorisFX.com/blog/AOTC, and there's a bunch of great visuals in this particular episode. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Ace Eddie-nominated editor Keith Fraze discusses editing the Oscar Best Picture-nominated film, Past Lives. Congratulations on editing this film.
Thank you so much. It's been a trip to be a part of.
Any clue that this was going to have this kind of resonance with an audience, the Academy?
I have a ton of anxiety and a lot of PTSD from past projects of mine. Celine, the director, she's a very confident person, and she knew the story she was trying to tell and everything. And from the get-go, she had so much confidence in the film. And I was always very excited and like, well, I know I love it, but I've been wrong before. And I'm never really sure how something's going to come out or how it's going to affect people and such. And so I kept waiting. You know, we were showing it to people and people were having very moving experiences with it from pretty early on. And I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. When is someone going to tell us that this is just not working, where we're going to have to fix everything or have to strip it all down and rebuild it and stuff like that? It was even that first screening that we had at Sundance, because we premiered the movie at Sundance. I was trying to enjoy it, but I was just so nervous. I remember walking out after the movie finished and there was a big applause and everything. And I was with my assistant editor. I'm like, let's just go. I don't want to hear what anyone's saying. I don't want to hear them tearing the movie apart and so on and so forth. And it wasn't until the after party that we started hearing more from people. We started getting some reviews in. And I realized that, no, it actually was resonating with people. It wasn't until like the last second where I was actually finally able to let my anxiety down and really embrace the fact that people are being moved by this.
How did you and the director find each other?
That was just through my agent. She interviewed a bunch of people for the job. I was a little reticent, you know, to take it on because she's a first-time filmmaker. I had nothing to, you know, base this on. I mean, the script came to me. A lot of her collaborators have said this in other interviews. I mean, it was just the script that made all of us want to sign on to this thing. It was an incredibly powerful script. And she had such a clear voice in it already. And then you talk to her. We Zoomed was our first interview. This was still kind of in the dog days of COVID and such. So we didn't meet in person. We were talking over Zoom. From the get-go, I could tell that she knew exactly what she wanted to say. She was very clear and understanding of what she didn't know and where she was going to need help from a collaborator in the editing room. Any doubts that I had were completely dispelled. They were partially dispelled by the script and the power of the script, and then it was fully dispelled just by talking to her. And then, yeah, we just kind of hit it off, bonded over movies, just a typical thing with an interview, and she trusted me enough to say, all right, let's do this thing.
Oh, that's awesome. And where did you edit this?
Mostly it was, I was just at home. I mean, this was remote for all of shooting. So they shot first in New York. I forgot how many weeks. Then we actually had a month off where Celine came up to me. I live north of New York City. I live in Westchester. And so she kind of, you know, hop on the train, come up to my little village where I live. And we worked for a couple of weeks together. And then she went off to film the Korean part of the movie. So it was really nice to have those kind of couple of weeks to sort of get to know one another, sort of see what we had already. And she was learning a lot on set. She learned a lot in that little pause with our time in the editing room so that she felt even more confident when she went to Korea to kind of finish the shoot. And then I was working remotely while they're in Korea. And then when that finished, we worked a little bit at my house, but then we started to go in person and we cut at Company 3 here in New York City.
Talk to me about that little break between New York and Korea. And what did that teach you about the material you were about to get? In other words, you know, when you get dailies in the New York dailies, you don't know her that well. And then when you get the Korean dailies in, now you've had this chance to kind of understand her better. Did that make a difference?
Oh, yeah, definitely. First off, it took off some of the anxiety for me where, you know, I'm always anxious showing a director of the first assembly, right? And it was a little bit less anxious being like, well, here's half a film. I don't have to show you the full thing all in one go. And I'm like presenting it. So it felt a little bit more showing someone a work in progress in like, okay, here's just the bare bones of what we're working with. So Celine had spoken to me a bit before shooting began about style and kind of the tone she wanted for the film and whatnot. And she had sent me a bunch of films to kind of use as reference points, right? So I had some homework before things began. So we had those sort of talking points so we could have the same kind of vocabulary when we were discussing how we wanted to do things. This is even before she shot a frame of footage. I was watching a lot of Koreeda films. I was watching Edward Yang's Yi Yi. We watched My Dinner with Andre, some Wong Kar-wai films, stuff like that. So these were all the things that she was sort of like thinking of as sort of how she wanted to tell the story, right? From watching those films and having those discussions with her before she began shooting, I knew that we wanted to go into this with a very minimalist approach. Cut as little as possible. Every cut, she wanted it to have meaning and advance the story forward. So that was kind of my modus operandi while she was shooting that first batch, right? I'm going to challenge myself to see how little I can cut. So when I was showing her that sort of stuff, and I was playing around a lot with music and trying different things, when I first showed her the half of the film that we had shot during those 3 weeks, it was clear that we were on the same page with what we wanted the movie to be. The music, we were still trying to figure out exactly the tone of what it was supposed to be. It was during that time we decided that going forward, I was just going to strip out all the music and I was going to cut the movie without any music, which is very rare for me. I usually do all my assemblies with music and I'm very music forward in my editing. So this was kind of a fun challenge to be like, okay, we're just going to imagine what the music's going to be, but we're just going to cut without a soundtrack. So that was one sort of realization that we came to working together. But, you know, it really was just kind of vibing each other out, just kind of getting to know one another, understanding what our tastes were and where she wanted the performances to go. And I think what she was mostly looking at was how she was shooting stuff, you know, how that stuff was coming across in the editing room. She had never been in an editing room before. This is the first time. And also it was incredible how quickly she was able to learn from what she was doing, you know, the feedback that she was getting from what she had been shooting and how it was working in the edit. She was very quickly to be like, oh, okay, I know how I want to shoot these upcoming scenes. I know how I want to do this and how this is going to transition into this when we get back into the cutting room. Yeah, the one that struck me the most was actually Still Walking. I had never seen that film before. There was something about that movie with just, again, how exacting it was, how precise everything was. I can't remember all the details about it, but I remember there being certain edits in that movie where we would cut to a new angle for the first time, and it would kind of open up a new understanding of a particular character. There's a shot, I think, of the mother in that movie where all of a sudden we're cut and we're kind of an over-shoulder shot and she's sort of in darkness and she's saying something more dramatic than she had said before. I can't remember all the specifics, but I remember that edit sort of, again, like sort of just opening the movie up in a different way. Again, that movie is so sort of paced, I don't want to say meditatively paced, but it's just, it flows and it goes along at its own sort of gentle rhythms, but the film never feels like it's dragging or that it's slow. It just feels like these little subtle changes here and there, whether it be in the edit or whether it be in the composition or the performances, you're understanding the characters differently. And so a pretty simple story all of a sudden starts to open up and have all these different nuances and subtleties to them that make you like a detective and trying to figure out what these people mean to each other and stuff. Anyway, it was really kind of a revelation to me to watch these movies because, you know, so much in the edit, you're trying to solve problems, you're trying to fix performances, you're just jumping around in coverage just to make things work and to flow. And I was very fortunate that the actors really knew what they were doing. Celine knew what she was doing on set. The DP knew what he was doing. The footage that was coming back was wonderful and was most of the way there. It wasn't like I was having to solve a lot of problems. It was more I could just be like, okay, now I can use the edit to really convey new information, to convey new aspects of these characters and how they relate to one another in the way that Corrieta was sort of doing in his films.
You were talking about the cinematography and composition. That must have spoken to you about the pace that needed to happen. Or was it more her telling you or the reference films telling you the pace that you should be going at?
I guess it was kind of a combination of everything. Celine never really spoke to me prior to getting into the cutting room together about the pacing of the film and wanting it to have sort of a meditative sort of pace. But I think, you know, watching these films definitely had a big impact. And then also, yeah, definitely once the footage started to come in, as always, just letting the material sort of speak to me and tell me what it wants, you know, trying not to go against the grain. The way things were paced in the dailies was very much is the pacing of the movie. I'm riveted watching this stuff. I'm in it with these people and I want to sit with them. I want to sit with them as they're thinking through what they're going to say next, as they're absorbing the information they're receiving from the other characters. And so I don't want to rush that in the edit. So let's hold back. Let's let this thing breathe.
Speaking of breathing, there's moments of color in the film that they give you story, they give you character, and they give you a sense of place. Things like they go to the Statue of Liberty and there's shots of the wake of the boat and the skyline. Talk to me about using those and why have those in there.
So early on, Celine and I quickly figured out that we don't want to be using establishing shots. The movie is very much about a sense of place, time and place. New York City is very much a character in the film. Seoul is very much a character in the film. When they go to Montauk, that's a character in the film. All these different places are going to be characters. And so we didn't want to just be cutting to these wide shots just to get you situated in the place, but rather we wanted to be using these moments that set you in a place, but evoke something, right? That they give you some sort of color of what the feeling of these places are, right? And so I'm always on the hunt for those types of shots that can ground you in the reality of the space and the environment, but evoke something. You try to say what they are and it starts to sound corny, but you know, so I can talk about like the, you know, the wake of the boat, the churning sort of waters having something to do with what Nora and Haesung are sort of feeling inside. But once you give it sort of words like that, it starts to sound corny. But if you just put them there and it feels right, those are the shots I play around with the most. Like, you know, let's take these random expressive shots and see where they drop in. There's a shot that I really, really love in the movie. Probably my favorite shot in the whole movie is when they first get to Montauk. Like one of our first establishing shots is just like of a lemon and like a glass of water on a counter. Something random, I think Shab happened to shoot when they had some downtime. But I was like, oh, this feels so painterly. I love the shot. We got to use it somewhere. And so that shot, I would just kind of throw around different places in the timeline until it finally was like, oh, you know what? Let's just introduce Montauk with this shot. I don't know what it means. I don't know what it's saying, but it has some sort of ineffable quality to it that feels like what like a morning in Montauk is going to feel like. And Nora sort of entering this space with these sort of emotions and feelings sort of floating around. So anyway, early on in my career, I did a lot of work with Terrence Malick, and he's very much obviously about the environs and how places can evoke certain things in you. And we're always cutting to different shots of flowers and trees and wheat and things like that, trying to like express what's going on inside the character through their environment. And so I think Celine, she let me play around a little bit with that, but was very clear about when something was really struck a chord with her, she knew it. And she was like, okay, we can indulge a little here because we're trying to really get into the inner life of these characters through the characters of the cities and the places around them.
I love that you called a shot of a glass of water with a lemon in it an establishing shot. An establishing shot is a wide shot of a place, basically. But what you're saying is, it's establishing the emotional context, right, of what you're about to see. I completely buy that definition.
You know, we're following these three characters, right? And so we're always just trying to make sure, like, where are these characters? Are we with them? What are they feeling? And especially when it comes to Nora, just sort of tracking her progress. It never really matters where she is in the city, but it matters where she is emotionally and where she is in the emotional setting of the narrative arc. That was always, you know, the name of the game with Celine. She had her meaning in hand from day one. She knew exactly what she wanted to say. And that allowed the experimentation that I was, you know, always want to do in the editing room. It made it so fun because when she feels it, I can trust that we're on the right track.
Oh, yeah. I just talked to an editor that was saying that one of the biggest things that a director can do for an editor is just to be very confident in the tone that they want and to be able to explain that tone to an editor.
Oh, 100%. You know, I never look to a director to have all the answers. I kind of don't want them to have all the answers. My favorite thing about editing is the collaborative nature. And I want the director to be able to diagnose, like, you know, this isn't working. We can't move past this. We need to solve this. And I can be like, okay, well, here's a bunch of answers. Here's a bunch of ideas. You know, I'll propose, you dispose, you know, that kind of a thing. I guess the way I always describe it, and I think I talked to Celine about this early on, you know, what I'm looking for a director is not to have a clear vision about what they want, but they have an idea. They have a hazy vision. And over time through editing, we're going to make that vision come into focus. And my job is that I'll be the optometrist and I'll, you know, which one's better, one or two. And she'll be the one who chooses it and keeps leading me down until that vision is clear.
I had never heard the pose and dispose thing, but I'm stealing that because that is just brilliant. I absolutely love that.
The most fruitful stuff came out of, we have a problem. The sequence isn't quite working. I don't quite know how to solve it. And let's just shoot the shit for a little bit. You know, let's talk about movies that we like. Let's talk about movies that kind of remind us of this moment. And, you know, we'll be talking for an hour and be like, oh, I saw this one movie. Like, you know, what about this kind of thing? Or just sort of talking about our love of cinema in general. And we could be talking about something that has nothing to do with that moment. But then it'll spark something. It'll spark some idea in one of us. Like, hey, wait a second, that could actually, you know, let's try this. And so much of the editing room, at least when I'm in the editing room, so much of it is the solutions come out of these just kind of conversations in general about, I mean, not just about movies, but about life in general, you know? And I just love those moments when, like, we'll be talking, an idea will spark. Hey, let's just play around with it. Let's see. Oh, it's almost working. Now let's keep going, you know, one step further. And it's almost like the universe is like providing you these answers, right? Between the connection that you have between you and the director, there's something about that spark that the universe is just like, okay, I'm going to give you this, like you both, this sort of mental image of how to move this forward a little bit more. And that, to me, is really where the magic of editing kind of exists. Sometimes it's tension and friction. Sometimes it's pure harmony. But it's between that connection between the editor and the director that I think the magic comes from.
Amen. So much of what we do is not in the timeline. You mentioned the shot of the wake at the boat when they go to Statue of Liberty. And I've been on a lot of ferry boats in my life. And I have stared into that wake thinking so often. Maybe that means something for somebody else different. As an editor, right, you don't have to impose the meaning on that wake shot on me, the audience. I can watch it and go, oh, that's my contemplation spot. And somebody else could say, oh, it's turbulence of emotion. And they have a totally different interpretation of the shot. And both of us get something from the film that is different, but equally valid.
I always have a bin in my projects of like shots that evoke something in me that I can't quite put my finger on, right? There's just something about it. It just evokes feeling. So I just put them in a bin. And whenever I run into some sort of issue or some sort of transition that isn't quite working, I'll just throw them in there and just see, you know? Sometimes I just kind of close my eyes and just kind of randomly drop them into the cut. And just, you know, I think...
Can you throw a dart at an avid?
There you go. I don't like being precious about my edits. I very much advocate for if something's not working, let's tear it down and rebuild it just to see, you know? We always got the old sequence. Why not? And sometimes I'll just take stuff and like, all right, I have an edit here. I think it's kind of working, but I don't know. I'm just going to quickly close my eyes and reorder every shot. I'll even leave the soundtrack the way it is. I'll just move everything around and just see, like, all right, universe, tell me, is any of this working? And sometimes I'll do that and there'll be like one transition. I'm like, oh, that's something I wouldn't have thought of. This is kind of interesting. Hey, Celine, get over here. Take a look at this. Is this kind of interesting? Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. And then sometimes we'll build a scene based on that kind of random transition that just happened to fall because I moved stuff around. Anyway, so this is all just like sort of my philosophy of you don't have to say what the meaning is. It just has to move you. And you have to be aware of what's moving you. But I always put them off to a side somewhere. And if there's a scene that we cut out that I'm just like, okay, but this one moment seems interesting. I don't know. Put that in a bin somewhere. Maybe that'll become a flashback or a memory or a dream or something later on. Who knows? But anyway, that's the kind of stuff that I love so much about movies is what I'm saying, the ineffable, the thing that you can't quite say what it is. You just know it has meaning to it.
Do you name that evocative bin the same thing on every project?
Well, I call it my boneyard. It's a term I've always just called it. I just assumed that was a term that everyone used.
Absolutely not. Okay. That is very interesting. I've got a buddy that has a junk in my trunk bin that he puts in every project.
That's better. I like that. Junk in my trunk. No, yeah, I've always just called it my boneyard.
Much of the film is dialogue-less. How are those scenes scripted, or weren't they?
Everything is scripted. I didn't have to build so much for this movie. You know, a lot of times while we're working on a film and there's like, I have to like try to cobble together something that wasn't really there before from half scenes or different things that were shot. But for this film, it was pretty easy to build to get that first assembly. And it was more about paring stuff down. Not to sound pretentious, but it was a lot like poetry where you're like, you write a lot and then you get the red pen out and you just cross stuff off until you have just what you need. Everything in there is doing something and evoking a specific idea or thought or emotion. So that's what we did with Past Lives. Was I think the first edit that we had was probably like 2.5 hours long. We watched it. We're like, well, a lot of this feels really great. We got to cut it down. Way too long.
What was the final time? I don't even know.
I think it was like 1:45. So we basically cut out like 45 minutes from that initial assembly. I mean, some of that was pacing, but a lot of it was like just things that we just felt like we didn't need, little transitions and stuff like that. More so than any other director I've ever worked with, she is willing, so willing to part with something that she feels is not absolutely essential. You know, a lot of writer directors you work with are going to be very, very precious about what they write, very, very precious about what they shoot. Especially a first-time filmmaker is going to be super precious about what they shoot because it's the first time they were putting their soul on film, right? And man, she was so quick to be like, you know what? I think we can get away without this. And I'd even argue with her. I'm like, wait a second, I love this scene. No. And we take it out and I'm like, oh, you're 100% right. This is way better. We don't need this. Anyway, so there's lots of stuff that was taken out. And then to your thought about like some of the silences and some of the like spaces between stuff, every scene had dialogue taken out of it. Celine wrote all of like, anytime there's like a long pause where she really wants the characters to be feeling something, for example, like, you know, there's really long pauses during Nora and Haesung's first breakup over Skype. She wrote all that stuff. She directed them all to like let's just linger in this. My first cut of that scene, I think, was probably even faster paced than what we eventually ended on because she was like, no, I want to sit with him. I want to feel what Haesung is feeling here. Let's just linger on him. He's doing a great performance. Let's not cut away. We'll cut away at the last possible second, right? When his emotion finally breaks. That was all her and her pushing for that. I never thought any of it was overwritten. I think she might say it was overwritten, but she would pare stuff down, take stuff out, like during the scene where they're in Dumbo and there's like these really long wide shots where they're sort of walking and we're sort of seeing them from a distance. There's a lot more dialogue there. And we were like, after a while, like, no, let's just take some of this out, pull it down. So they're just saying these little snippets to each other and we're letting, you know, those words linger in the air. They're mulling over it. They're mulling over what they mean to each other, what these words mean, you know, that they're each one of them is saying. And she was like, let's let the audience feel that as well. So, you know, it's our tendency in modern day life to just to talk, as I'm doing now and rambling on. But because so much of this movie is about people feeling out what the situation is and feeling out what the other person is sort of thinking and wondering about, like we wanted to let those moments sort of breathe. So the audience could feel it and try to become the detectives as well to see what each one was feeling.
The Dumbo scene is also one where there's almost what you would normally call an establishing shot of the whole park, right? Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
And they're walking way off. They're an inch tall on the screen or 2 inches tall on the screen, something like that. Very far away. And instead of eventually cutting to them in a steady cam shot, walking and talking, it's that wide shot, the entire conversation, correct? Or very close to it.
There's only one cut in there. We cut to one front-on shot at a very specific time and then kind of cut back to that wide shot for when they leave frame and kind of leave the, I think it's the Manhattan Bridge in the distance. I don't think Celine shot any coverage for that. She knew she wanted to do that. It was going to be a little bit more of a talky scene than what it eventually became because, like I said, we did strip out lines from that scene. Because you can't really see them, so they're in the distance. So we were like, okay, we can take out as many lines as we want. You can't really tell that their lips are moving. But she knew she wanted to kind of start on the train, kind of going by and coming down and gently following them as they arrive. And, you know, we're just kind of lingering and sort of experiencing this conversation with them. Even though they're really, really small, there's something about it as they grow closer in frame, as they become more honest with one another, maybe, like they're growing closer towards us. And we don't cut. The only coverage they shot for that is this beautiful sort of front-on shot where like the wind is blowing the bushes in the background. And to the eagle-eyed observer, they can see that every other person who's there is a couple. That was one of Celine's sort of like fun little directorial choices, is that everybody is coupled there. And so we cut to the front and we see that for the first time, that everyone around them is together and we're sort of pushing in on them. But that's the only cut that we do in the scene, is right when they've kind of run out of things to say. And then we cut and we're just sort of looking at them for a moment as the wind is blowing. And Nora, I forget what she says next, we sort of bring, you know, moves on the conversation to something else. That was such a fun thing to be able to do because I know we're going to linger on this. Can we cut anywhere? Well, let's cut it right at this moment where Haesung has just said something kind of honest. And he's talking about the girl that he'd been dating back in Korea and why they split up. And he's kind of made some sort of self-reflection about like his worth, right? and Nora doesn't know what to say. And so then we're like, great, now we can cut. We can go to a new angle and see them from in a different light. These are the kind of edits that were so fun to kind of talk about. It's like, how can we be very, very precise about this and really have meaning behind these different jumps that we're doing?
There's another non-cut scene that I wanted to talk about, and you may say again that there was no coverage for it. There's a scene in bed about dreaming in Korean, and the whole thing is played on a two-shot, but you could have cut back and forth on close-ups if you'd wanted to. Talk to me about that choice and whether you had coverage.
So that scene, we did have coverage. We didn't have a whole lot of coverage, but we did have, we had the close-ups and medium shots on everybody. And that scene does have cuts early on in it. It's the very ending of the scene when they finally sort of turn towards one another and are kind of drifting off towards sleep, and the camera sort of moves in slowly. That's where we linger for a very, very long time. Celine shot some coverage for that last part, but I think it was always kind of implicit. I'm like, okay, I can tell this is meant for, we're going to do this in a one or this last shot. All the scene was kind of building up to get us to that moment. That is a scene that was very, very tough because they're not moving. They're pretty much just laying in bed. The cuts have to be very precise to work for continuity's sake, but then also because we don't want to be cutting too much, because we want to let the actors, when we cut to one of the actors' close-ups, we want to linger on them for a while. They're going to say some lines, they're going to be listening. So what are the key moments where we want to be on Arthur? What are the key moments where we want to be on Nora? And that scene was about twice as long that was shot. So that scene has a lot of dialogue taken out of it. That was more of a calibration of trying to arrive at Arthur's character. It was just a delicate balancing act. So Arthur didn't feel too, woe is me. You know, like he's trying to be empathetic towards Nora and understand where she's at and where she's feeling. He's also trying to express his own feelings and be honest about where he's at. And it was a very kind of delicate balancing act of not making it seem like he was trying to overtake her narrative by trying to center himself too much, right? So that was kind of tricky. That took a lot of back and forth to figure out what to take out. That was the sort of first half of the scene that took a lot of working and reworking to figure out how to do it so precisely, so that we could at the end, really it's when Nora and Arthur turn towards one another. They're always talking toward one another, but Arthur's kind of on his back, looking up at the ceiling. Nora's sort of like trying to get close to him. She has this beautiful look on her eyes looking at him. I think she's trying to lighten the mood a little bit. She said something a little funny. She's just a girl from Korea, and she kind of gives a little wink to him. He's like, you're not really hearing what I'm saying. And he turned towards her fully. It's at that moment that we cut wide to sort of see the two of them together in the marital bed. They are as close as they've ever been in that scene, but we're kind of as wide as we've ever been in that scene. As he starts to share more and more about his inner workings, his thoughts, why he's learning Korean, because he's trying to connect to her. He's trying to get closer to her. He's trying to understand what she's saying in her dreams. The camera gets closer and closer. So it just kind of felt right. The whole last part of that scene has sort of a visual narrative arc that sort of mirrors the emotional arc that's happening in that moment. So yeah, it was kind of obvious not to cut out of that too soon.
If you assume that the first scene in the movie is present day, the entire movie basically is a flashback. Was that the structure, I'm assuming, or was that devised later?
Nope, that was always the structure. It was always a structure to start with that shot. There's actually small subtleties, subtle changes that are different from the opening shot, like where people are in relation to things versus where they are when we cut back to it at the end of the film, that scene at the bar. But that was always because Celine knew that she wanted to start the movie like this. So yeah, that was totally scripted. Starting with the voiceover, starting with that push-in, and then even the word choice of, she said 24 years earlier, and then later on with 12 years pass. There was a lot of discussion that we would have, because people would come in and be like, why are you saying 12 years pass, rather than, you know, normally you say 12 years later, or something like that. And she's like, no, it's so important, this word choice, because it evokes something happening. There's an action to it. 12 years are passing. We're not just jumping time and saying, this is 12 years later. We're saying, what you just saw was time moving, and it's an experience that you're having. And she was very like specific about that had to be the word choice, to throw some more praise on her, how she's thinking about these choices and how she was almost always 100% right in how she was thinking about them and what she wanted to do. My relationship with A24 and with Killer Films and 2AM, it was such a wonderful working relationship. I've always had challenges in editing rooms where, you know, there's always, people have disagreements about where the film should be or where it should go, what the direction should go in. There's always fights and blah, blah, blah. And everyone, you know, is trying to get their two cents in. And this was such a pleasant experience. It even made me even more paranoid. I'm like, what's happening here? This is not normal. This is not a normal cutting room where everyone's just kind of happy and sort of like totally on the same page. And I don't know if that was just because, again, I think everyone just sort of was like, Celine knows what she's doing. We're going to trust her. She knows the story she's trying to tell. And like, you know, the proof is in the pudding. She's getting good results here. I don't know if that's just how A24 and killer films like normally work. Yeah, it was incredible to be part of something where everyone was in agreement about the things that were working and wasn't working. It made going to work so much more pleasurable. Really, the only thing I was dealing with was my own anxieties, which I can only deal with so much. And I'm sure I'll work through that with my therapist one day. But the relationships that we had in the cutting room were by far the best I've ever had in any cutting room.
Moments of awkward silence or waiting, how long to play them? So you mentioned that one Zoom call to take it literally until the actor broke, right? Were there other scenes like that?
Yeah. Well, it was always a matter of like, let's hold on to the shot as long as we possibly can. Actually, every shot was like that, even if it's a shot that's a short shot. It was like, we're here, let's stay here until the... When I say when the actor breaks, I don't mean like he lost the character. It's when the emotion changes or like, you know, when you feel the musical shift in the performance or whatever. And so we were always doing that. And sometimes we would just linger longer. Sometimes we felt like the rhythm had to be a little, you know, a little quicker and we wanted to get over to see something different. A lot of this all stems from in the script. And I remember reading this, first time reading it, I was like, oh, the script is reading really well. I'm really enjoying this. You finally get to like the final bar scene and so many ideas that had been laid earlier kind of come together. And you're like, and I was like, oh, wow, this is, I got to work on this. But then in the script, you get to the final scene at the end where they're waiting for the Uber. And Celine wrote into the script, and we will wait a full 2 minutes in silence as we're waiting for the Uber to come. And I just remember thinking, you know, and that was bolded in the script. And I was like, oh, that is so ballsy. I am so excited to work on this. And that sort of set the tone for everything. If we're going to be able to do that at the end, what else can we play with earlier on? Like, how much can we push, you know, just like lingering on things and just letting these things play out, let it breathe and not be too worried about the pace of the thing. Because there's not a whole lot of story that's being told, right? Everything is sort of the feeling and the emotion and the vibes of it. So let's just linger and like look at these people's faces. I mean, Teo, Greta, and John did such amazing work. And they're such beautiful people on the inside. I mean, I've had the pleasure of meeting them, you know, briefly, but they seem like such wonderful people. I just want to look at them. I want to experience them. I want to understand them through their faces. So much of it was like, just let the story be told with their expressions and their looks. And I want to see... I mean, I always keep going back to the first breakup between Nora and Hae-sung, just because you see Hae-sung's face, you see his expression change, you know, 5 or 6 times in one shot. And it isn't until he's done, he's ready to hang up, that I want to cut away from it. I want to linger with him and see the roadmap of his face as he experiences the full weight of what's happening. That's sort of my mantra at every cutting room I go into. I always want to just linger on stuff as long as possible until I want to cut as little as possible. I think it's just kind of the kind of movies that I prefer. But this is the first time really like a director has said, all right, let's do that. Let's challenge ourselves and really, you know, really go for it.
I love the idea that you mentioned how much you cut out of the film, 45 minutes, and that you cut out 45 minutes, but you still have 2 minutes of waiting for an Uber, and you still have this long wait of the Zoom call, and you're willing to sit in these moments, despite the fact that you're trying to make the film as propulsive as it needs to be.
Movies can be 4, 5, 6 hours long and feel like they're 90 minutes, and a movie can be 90 minutes and feel like it's, you know, a million hours long. So as long as the emotion is potent and, you know, you're with the characters, it's going to feel like it's all flowing along. So that's really, you know, the main thing that we kept in mind. And the way I like to think about this is one scene that we cut out, there was a scene, this is with in the childhood section, and it's right before we cut to the 12 years pass. Nora is arriving with her family into Canada for the first time, and she's at school, and there's a kind of a tracking shot of all the kids playing in the schoolyard, and she's kind of at the like, up against the wall by herself. And then we cut to this close-up of her, and she's sort of looking uncomfortable in this new world of hers, right? And that's when we cut away to 12 years pass. Well, there was a whole scene there. There was a whole scene that took place where like some boys come up and kind of tease her a little bit and make her feel uncomfortable. And we had that in there for a long time, close to the lock of the picture. It never was really landing quite right for us. We always felt like it wasn't the right tone for this moment, but we didn't know how to get out of it. We're making this huge leap. This is the first time we're leaping forward 12 years. This is very important. Looking in my little bin of special stuff, there was this shot of the young girl who played Nora. It wasn't meant to be shot. They had started rolling the camera for the scene. The actors were late. The two boys were supposed to come into the scene were late coming in. They couldn't find them. They were off playing somewhere. And they just forgot to yell cut. And so this little girl is just sitting there, the camera's on her, and she's looking uncomfortable, looking around, not really sure what to do with herself, and just being awkward in that way that, you know, preteen children are. We're like, great, this is perfect. This says everything we want to say, everything we want to say in this one shot, and it's a moment of silence, so we can use that instead of having this whole dialogue scene that we were supposed to have, and it conveys it better than what the other thing was. So these moments of silence where we're just looking at these people can convey so much more of the story than what has actually been written. And I think that that one case is a perfect example of it.
That's so interesting, because the other thing that I think of when I think of that story, having seen enough dailies where that kind of thing happens, is that would just be written down as NG.
Yeah.
Right? That would have to be a clip where they just said, this take is bad.
Yeah. I actually have told my assistant editor, Shannon Fitzpatrick, who I do want to shout out, who's amazing. I've told her, like, yeah, never label anything NG because I won't look at it. And I want to look at it. You know, I want to look at everything. But I know myself. I know I'll just ignore these things because there's always, you're always getting a million dailies. You're just trying to get through stuff. And I, so many times in the past, I have discovered that, oh, wait, this thing that was labeled no good is a gem. You know, you always got to look at heads and the tails of the shots and see what little gems await you when the actors aren't fully acting out the scene that was written. No NG, never allowed to be written in the dailies.
I love talking about assistant editors, and we definitely need to give them their due. So, you know, tell me a little bit about her and what she did on the film and your relationship.
Yeah. So my assistant is, her name is Shannon Fitzpatrick, and she was actually credited as an additional editor on this film. I mean, I think all assistant editors are collaborators in the cutting room, but I do think Shannon kind of went above and beyond. And this again goes to sort of Celine's philosophy of collaboration and how she collaborates with any of her partners on a film. There's a lot of filmmakers you encounter who have a big ego, are insecure about their ideas, insecure about what they're trying to do. And so they tend to emphasize that ego more and they try to shut people out, right? Well, Celine, I think, had the best of both worlds, where she is, again, so confident in what she wanted, but also very open and understanding of what she didn't know and what she was open to receiving input about, right? So that fostered a very collaborative environment in our cutting room. And I've heard, and also on set and everything like that, but I can only speak to the cutting room. We would watch the movie constantly. We would watch the movie every couple of days, just Celine, myself, and Shannon. Shannon would always come in. And Shannon was always our sort of eyes and ears. When Celine and I were trying to work on something crazy, we're not sure if it was going to work, we were like, all right, Shannon, you tell us if this is working or not. And so Shannon was very much an equal sort of voice in those discussions. Each one of us came to the cutting room with sort of different tastes, different experiences. We're all very different people in our personal lives, and it sort of created this sort of triumvirate. Shannon, Celine, and I were all on a text thread together. We're always talking about movies and stuff like that and going out to eat together. It allowed us to feel like there was a team and there was a tripod, right? Like, you're not, it never felt like it was all on me to sort of solve it. It was never all on Celine to have to solve it. I mean, she was the one leading us and guiding us, but it really, I think, helped to have these different voices in the cutting room together to sort of feel like this. It made it pleasurable, made it enjoyable. And I think it really helped the work. And we each had our little pet scene that we wanted to see in the movie. And if it got cut out, we'd be like, oh no, that was a scene that I loved. But by trusting the other voices in the room, I was like, oh, okay. Celine and Shannon both think that the scene should be cut out. All right, I'll let it go. When you can have a room that feels like that, where everyone is sort of working in concert with one another in that way, if you're lucky enough to have it be three voices rather than just two, then I think it just makes the work even better.
When you first met Shannon, what was it that made you think that she would be a good fit for you as an assistant?
I was actually trying to find a Korean-speaking assistant, and I couldn't. There's a woeful lack of Korean-speaking editors and assistants in the world, and I hope we rectify that soon, because I don't speak Korean. Celine obviously is fluent in both English and Korean, but I wanted to have somebody in the cutting room who could help me as I was making the assembly. But Shannon just came to me because she was recommended by our post-production supervisor. I had a quick conversation with her. She seemed great, but I had no idea that she was going to be that good of a collaborator. But she just has such a dense knowledge of film. She wrote her school thesis on the films of Archipong Wazikerthal. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
I'm going to need a spelling on that because I don't know that.
Well, he's the one who did Memoria, and he did Uncle Boonmi, who can recall his past lives. He's a Buddhist filmmaker. His movies are very long and lingering and slow-paced, and so she's very much in that sort of vein, and she's very intelligent about what things can mean, looking at the different shades of meaning in a somewhat obscure, obtuse movie. So, but I just got lucky. I just got lucky that, you know, I knew she could do the work, but she ended up becoming a stronger collaborator than I could have hoped for.
So the film starts with this scene in a bar, some people trying to figure out what the relationship is between three people that they're looking at. And later on, we come back to that scene. There's a scene in the bar between the husband and Hae-sung, played in a wide shot. Was there coverage there, or you decided to play it in a wide?
No, I'm glad you bring that up. So yes, there was coverage, and for a long time that scene cut to the overs of for each one of them. Again, just trying to like size each one of them up. And that scene also had more at the tail. There was kind of more to that scene, played out a little bit longer. And, you know, we cut it down for various reasons, but because we thought it was that was the right time to kind of cut out is whenever they're talking about it, you know, the in-yun between each one of them. The reason why we decided to go for the wide shot, I think it was actually, I think this was one of the few times where I was like, I think I may have suggested it to Celine. She usually is the one who's suggesting stuff. Like, hey, we'll just try this. And that might have been the one time I was like, you know what? I love this wide shot. Can we just do it in the wide shot? And I remember this is another one of those moments where we were kind of shooting the shit about different films. This always reminds me of the scene in the Kurosawa film, the sequel to Yojimbo. I think it's called Shinshiro. There's a duel between the two samurais, between Toshirô Mifune and the bad guy. And literally the shot, it's just one shot. It's like a medium shot of the two of them that are staring at each other. They got their hands on their swords. And they're not moving for a minute, 2 minutes. I can't tell you how long it is. And finally, they both move at the same time. And Toshirô Mifune's character, you know, cuts the other guy and it's just a gush of blood comes out. It's this incredibly tense and climactic battle scene that happens with just two characters staring at each other. And so I kept telling her, this is that scene. This is our Shinshiro's scene. I think that's why it might work just playing it in this wide shot, because we're just going to look at them sort of existing in the space next to each other. This is the first time they've been in a place together without Nora around. You know, what's going to happen? It's as tense as that samurai scene. That sort of discussion sort of led us to feel like we could be bold enough to just sort of sit in this wide shot so that we couldn't see their expressions that well. We couldn't get the full view of everything and allow us to sort of lean in and wonder, like, well, how do they feel towards one another? Like, are they being genuine? Are they being like open to one another? Is there still some reticence? There must be. It just has so many more questions that are in the air if you're not given the full picture of the thing. Whereas if you cut to the close-ups, that's what you're getting. You're getting exactly what everyone's feeling at that time. And I think we wanted to make it a little bit more obscure in that way.
And that wide shot's on their backs. They're kind of turned sideways to each other. It's almost a 50-50.
But. Right. Well, yeah, Heisung is turned towards him because he's trying to talk to Arthur. But Arthur, you barely see any of his face. And that's what I like so much about it. Because he's the one you're like, how are you feeling, man? You just sat there listening, maybe picking up some of their conversation, maybe not. Who knows how much you know? He's the inscrutable one, and he's the one I most want to know. And it's one of those, it's just that thing of like, I keep wanting to lean to the side to see around his face. Like, and that's what you want the audience to do. You want them to want something that they're not getting because it makes them lean forward and like, and feel it more, right? So, no, I love that. I'm so happy that ended up working, that shot.
I think that ending on the lean forward moment is a great place to wrap this up. So thank you so much for a really fascinating discussion. Wow, I learned so much. Thank you.
Oh my goodness, this was absolutely my pleasure. I love talking about this stuff. Yeah, this was great. Thank you so much.
That's it for Out of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. There's a lot of really good visual content in this particular episode. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Keith Fraze for joining us on Art of the Cut to discuss the Oscar Best Picture nominated film, Past Lives. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Holfish, ACE. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And follow me on Twitter at @SteveHolfish.